the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by.
This is Athena Melville, welcoming you to this August 5th, 2010 edition of Education Now. In this edition, we share our interview with Katie Faber, author of Why Great Teachers Quit and How We Might Stop the Exodus. Katie Faber is a 5th and 6th grade teacher at Rumini Memorial School in Middlesex, Vermont. Prior to that, she taught 5th grade at Twinfield Union School and environmental education at the Taconic Outdoor Education Center in Cold Spring, New York. She has a master's degree in teaching with a specialization in science, grades 7 through 9, from the State University of New York at Pittsburgh. Katie has served as a teacher mentor, service learning consultant, and teacher leader in her district. A documentary film by Noodlehead Network called Is This Going to Be on the Test? Place-Based Learning, Kids Exploring Their Own Community, was created about the service learning projects completed by her students in 2002. Katie wrote a teacher's guide to accompany this film. She is also a contributor to the book Reading to Learn, a Classroom Guide to Reading Strategy Instruction, published by the Vermont Strategic Reading Initiative and the Vermont Department of Education in 2004. In the fall of 2009, Katie received an Earthwatch Educator Fellowship to participate in a 10-day science research expedition to Louisiana to survey swamps and cypress forests for the effects of climate change and extreme weather. She had the opportunity to communicate with her students via blog posts and internet video to engage them in real-life science research and field-based learning. Katie is married to Kurt Budlinger, a professional photographer, photography teacher, and former public school teacher. They have 2 daughters and live in Vermont. You can comment on this interview at any time at hermes@pacific.net or on the Education Now Facebook page. And now we'll get started. Well, welcome to the Education Now, Katie Faber. It's so wonderful.
Thank you.
It's so wonderful to have you here, talking to you there in Vermont. It's a beautiful morning here in Mendocino County. I don't know what the weather is like there, but maybe you could tell us.
Well, it feels like a September day, actually. It's a little bit chilly, but it's quite nice after the warm weather we've had around here lately, so it's actually a treat.
It's a treat. Well, it's 10 o'clock here, and it's 1 o'clock or a little bit after 1 o'clock there in Vermont. And I've just really enjoyed so very much reading your book, Why Great Teachers Quit and How We Might Stop the Exodus. And I'm just delighted to talk with you and share you with our listeners. So,
thank you so much, Athena.
Yeah, you know, from the introduction, you know, you say the book is designed to be immediately useful to teachers, administrators, educational leaders, and lawmakers. So this book is relevant to everyone. And I think the only people left out there is parents, and I think it's terrifically relevant to parents as well.
And I do as well. I started thinking about that and sort of talking about that on some of the parenting blogs, because I think parents are experiencing some of this as well with their own children.
Yes. You're breaking up a little bit, and I don't know if it's the phone connection or if you're on a cell, then just please stay in the same place.
Okay.
Okay.
Is this a little better now?
Yes, that is better.
Okay.
I'd like to start right from, you know, I'd like to go by chapter, if that's all right with you. And the first chapter is the one, of course, that really is important. I think is the most important. I know all of them are important, every single one of them. Mm-hmm. But standardized tests.
Yeah.
And
Well, I would... Oh, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I would love to tell you just how I came about starting this book. I didn't really intend to write it at all. I was just mentoring a newer teacher, and I thoroughly enjoyed working with her. She was obviously born to be a teacher. She was incredible. The students adored her. The staff loved working with her. She was a clear communicator, positive, absolutely a fantastic teacher. And she came into our school, and she quit within 2 years, and she went to a job at the state level, and completely out of teaching. And I was really distraught about her leaving, and I really wanted to think about, why is this happening? Why is this exceptional person who I hoped that my two young children would have, why did she quit, and why are there others like her? So I pretty much just started from there and started reading, researching, thinking, and writing about the reasons that teachers, great teachers, walk away from the classroom really forever. And I started from there, and I just started to develop these themes around what I heard back from people. I heard back from people on blogs, on email, through face-to-face interviews, and pretty much just reached out to my colleagues and my friends, and it really blossomed from there to be over 70 people that I ended up talking with directly and having a lot of two-way communication with as I developed the themes that you're starting to talk about in the chapters. They emerged because I heard so much about them from a variety of teachers across the country. And I know these aren't exhaustive reasons that teachers quit, but these are certainly the themes that came up to me the most. And with the most emotion, actually. So I thought I'd present these in this way, knowing it's not all of the reasons why teachers quit, but it's certainly the ones that I heard about in my research.
Yes, and that is so wonderful, the way that you include the different teachers that you've experienced and their reasoning in the book. I highly recommend the book to everyone, and I'm hoping... that with this interview, more people will want to experience the book because it's just a powerhouse, in my opinion. So
thank you.
Let's start with the standardized testing. And you say that many school districts reported increasing time for ELA and math and decreasing time in other subjects since 2001.
That's right.
That social studies and science were more likely to lose minutes than recess, PE, or art. I found that extremely interesting, and I thought it must be very annoying to you since you are a science teacher. And
it is.
And I was really glad that they weren't taking any time out of a recess, but they are, you're saying.
Well, it seems to come more from the other areas. The study that I did see said that they were more likely to take it from the other curricular areas and then push it into literacy and math, which we all know are hugely important skills. But so are science, you know, science skills and social studies, and I mean, it's all important. And certainly, recess is really important for brain development.
I mean, without
fighting obesity. So,
without recess and PE. Your brain can't develop so that you can absorb the social studies and the science. So
I mean, I've seen some research about that. You've got to have recess. You've got to have that time for the body to work and process. But what, you know, I'm concerned that, I think schools all over the nation are facing different things as they focus on the test, or getting ready for the test. And some schools, I'm sure, are losing science and social studies. Some might even be losing recess. Some might be losing more integrated art experiences, for example. So I think it's just changing the nature of teaching in public schools in a way that I think we ought to be looking at.
It does, and I have a terrific prejudice against the standardized tests. I feel that they're biased, and that they don't really tell you anything about the student. The teacher couldn't tell you, and so I have a very difficult problem with it. And I think that it's remarkable. I want to give the teachers who are sticking it out and going ahead with it and doing all that they can, I want to just give them, you know, a crown or something for sticking it out. But mostly I worry about the kids. I know that there are great teachers working their hardest, and I've had a lot of them on Education Now. And just doing such a fantastic job against all odds. And yet it's hard for me to believe that we just can't get rid of them, can't get rid of the standardized tests, knowing how bad they are for kids. And I really don't believe that they can tell you anything that a teacher can't tell you about that student from working with a student and from observation. Now, there was a time when they used to say they weren't going to use these to label the kids, these standardized tests. They were just going to use them to assess how their progress was going. And in my opinion, that's the first mistake we made, was believing that they wouldn't be used the way that they're using them now. Well, let's move on then, unless there's something more you'd like to say, Katie.
I would like to say that you know, I'm not even for completely abandoning the standardized tests necessarily, but I think when you have a third grader who can't sit for more than 15 minutes at a time taking a test for 2 hours, and they're physically and emotionally not really prepared to do something like that, we have teachers telling me that their students are, you know, are nauseous, have headaches, they're physically squirming with discomfort. We've got to think about that. And I think the point that you made about it's really a snapshot of a particular day. And as teachers, we see the whole child in their achievement in so many capacities, you know, and maybe looking more at a performance-based portfolio of things that children are doing to really look at as an assessment. And I know that lots of people that I referenced in the book are calling on an assessment plan that's more like that it's including a larger picture of the child than just that snapshot we see on the test-taking day.
Yeah, the whole thing, the whole child. Okay. Well, now, Violence and Safe Schools, Chapter 2, is a quote from the book, "Walking hand-in-hand with violence is another big problem, the broken down, outdated, and unsafe physical condition of school buildings. Many of our nation's schools are old and decaying, causing health problems for the teachers and students who inhabit them on a daily basis." And then you tell Carla's story. You want to tell our listeners Carla's story?
Sure. Carla was a music teacher in Connecticut, and she basically, just from the working conditions in her school, she started to face quite a lot of problems with asthma, and she had repeated infections that she was on antibiotics for, and she was, you know, she was just having a difficult time, and she was a very well-loved teacher. She built a really strong music program, and she just started to really have trouble with her health. And she went through a very long process of meeting with the administrators, and it took actually quite a long time for them to take her complaints pretty seriously, and it describes this in the book, in the story. And finally, she ended up having to, you know, talk to the NEA and come up with the National Education Association and think about, you know, potential action about it. And it's not something she wanted to do, but she was to the point where her doctor told her to not walk into the school because it was so detrimental to her health. And what I really thought about when she told me this story in our interview is I thought about, think about all the children and their vulnerable and developing bodies.
Yes.
In a school that's affecting this adult so adversely. I started to get really concerned about them because since they're growing, their bodies are much more susceptible to toxins in the environment, and I was really concerned about those kids in this whole several month process of her being sick and talking to people, and it took so long, but in the meantime, while that was happening, the children were continually exposed to poor air quality within the schools. So this is a big problem, and the working conditions chapter, it has a huge range of things. I mean, it, you know, starts out with the extremes, with violence, you know, chronic violence in schools and physical threats to teachers, and it goes all the way through things like teachers not finding time to use the bathroom. I mean, there's such a range of issues that teachers are facing as far as working conditions goes, and it doesn't, every school, it seems to me, is facing some sort of working conditions issue. Because they're public, they're underfunded, and a lot of them are in need of repair. And teachers are too busy usually to do a lot of advocacy around this. And it's a very challenging issue facing our nation.
It is a very challenging issue facing our nation, and I think it's something I wish that the unions would take it up more strongly, frankly, but. And I also feel that these old buildings, they're like mausoleums, and that it would be so much better if they rented out homes that, you know, and met children in homes, and instead of these huge mausoleum buildings that are just, they must be just outrageous to heat, and let alone just not feeling very warm and welcoming. You would think if you change the environment that and the working conditions, you would save money, really, and then you would be offering the teachers and the students such a more healthy environment. But so that's where I went with that whole chapter. It was excellently done, and I just, once again, the teachers who stick it out, wow, let's just congratulate them, and you're one of them.
Right. Well, thank you, and I just want people to advocate, you know, advocate for yourself, because it's something that we should really all be working on, and it's hard. I know we're all busy, but when you have something broken down in your school, or you're feeling a certain threat, or you're unhealthy, we've got to be speaking up about this because it's the children that are also facing this. It's everyone. So I really feel like we need to be working together to help support each other to speak up about the working conditions.
And that's what you say in the chapter 3 in the working conditions, that a growing number of cities, including San Francisco, have adopted the precautionary principle as guidance for a range of decisions to promote environmental health and safety, to reduce costs, and to promote sustainability in government practices, including switching to non-toxic cleaners and environmentally sound purchasing. And, you think that in a school that would have been the top priority a long time ago. I'm sorry to chuckle. I mean, what else can you do? But you'd have to cry otherwise.
Right. Yeah.
It's just.
It's a huge, important first step. It's just environmentally, you know, just to use the non-toxic products. It's a crucial first step to improve air quality right off the bat.
Right.
It's something schools can do relatively painlessly. Is they just have to change their contracts with different cleaning companies. And we've done it at our school, and there's data to support that children are much healthier in the schools where they take just that one simple action.
Yes, but San Francisco's a pretty progressive community. So I'm not surprised that they're, you know, moving in this positive direction, but as a nation, and especially those children that always get squelched, you know, children of color and the poor, that's hard to think
about. You've got so many factors there. I mean, I know. It's unbelievable when you just consider that teacher attrition is highest at high poverty schools. And so there you've got that problem compounded by much more severe working conditions nationally.
Right.
And so it's just it feels to me like it's spiraling, particularly for those kind of schools. And it's just not okay.
Yeah. Well, let's move on then to Chapter 4, which you title Higher Expectations. And I was very impressed by this statement that Sherman Oaks provides built-in collaboration time for teachers. Not all schools are accepting the model of increasing expectations for teachers while not providing adequate built-in hours for planning, collaboration, and professional development. But at Sherman Oaks Community Charter School in California, teachers have 90 uninterrupted minutes daily to meet, collaborate, plan, and problem solve. How exciting! What a great model they are!
You had to wipe me off the floor when I read that. I was completely floored about that amount of time for school-based embedded professional development, which there's a real movement nationally for this kind of professional development that is absolutely relevant, that is on the ground, school-based, professional to professional, not an isolated workshop in some distant city that doesn't pertain to what we do. So this was really, really surprising and encouraging to me. I know that lots of schools are looking at ways they can have this embedded time with each other, this collaborative time, and it's huge. And I think it's really the future where we need to go if we're going to retain the highest quality teachers. We need to be talking to teachers across grade levels. They need to be meeting with each other about content, and we need to be looking at school plans and all of these things together as a staff in a professional way that respects everybody's time. So I know that lots of schools are starting to do this work, but Sherman Oaks was very impressive on their daily commitment to this kind of work.
Yes. Oh, yes. That just came out, and that struck me immediately. It was just so exciting. I mean, something so incredibly positive. Wow. Let's have more of that. Well,
that's exactly right.
Yeah. Now, that, of course, would help deal with the bureaucracy, which is the title of Chapter 5. I would just like you to talk about the bureaucracy, since I don't have to deal with it and never have, because I had a private school. So
I see.
Yes.
Well, basically, I feel like there's a lot of systems in public education that make innovative teaching harder. And I gave a few examples in the book, such as field trips. You know, you go on this, there's a lot of steps, there's a lot of work to do, there's a lot of process to follow. And when you're doing that, you're also teaching and grading and living. And what happens is I think some teachers just give up these kind of experiences altogether because bureaucratically they're very challenging. It's things like that, or overnight field trips. You know, there's the increased liability and anxiousness and funding and paperwork. And during my research, it really became clear to me that the bureaucracy and some of the systems that are set up for expediency for maybe administrative assistance or expediency for the central office, it's set up for that, but it's not necessarily set up to support innovative good teachers in the classroom in balancing their work. And I think we have to start viewing the lens of all of the things that need to be done to support innovative teaching. We need to really consider the ways that, from the teacher perspective, so we can continue this quality teaching. Otherwise, it's just not going to happen. And I think some things are just set up without that lens of what do we want to happen at our school? what kind of creative projects, field trips, school-wide events do we want to have, and how can we support teachers and parents in the community in developing those, and then work backwards and see what needs to be done to support it versus what's the easiest way administratively and then make everybody do those things that can take an exorbitant amount of time.
Right, right. That's where what their solution with the at the Sherman Oaks school where they meet all of them, administrators and teachers, and meet where this kind of an issue would be dealt with, right?
Right. You'd have that embedded time so you could meet and you could plan, let's say it's a school-wide event around an author. You know, it's a full-day celebration of an author, and maybe the students are dressing up in character, and each is coming
right.
in a character from their favorite book by that author. You would meet with all those teachers and plan that event. Could you imagine, you know, for 90 minutes, get it completely dialed. Everybody knows what they're going to do to support it versus the very hurried hallway conversation about the same thing while the one person's running to lunch duty and the other person's running to recess duty, and then you wonder why the event isn't as organized as it potentially could be or as you know, wonderful as it could be.
Right.
Because there's just a lot of people who don't have the time to get it all together because they don't have time to sit down and work it out.
Yes.
So I feel like there's real impacts of a lot of how schools are run on creative teaching and creative ideas for schools.
Yes. But if you have an open administrator, then do teachers have input in who the administrators are? At some schools, do they?
They do. They have interview committees that are made up of teachers, parents, community members, and then it goes through a process, you know, with the school board and with the superintendent. So they do. They do. I'm not necessarily speaking nationwide because I'm not sure of the whole processes there.
Right.
But I do know in our district they do. And that's why in the administrator's chapter, I just talk about trying to get feedback into that process and looking to try to hire administrators who have classroom experience, who are really familiar with what it takes to do the job well, who are open and supportive and all of those great things, and also providing mentorship for administrators in those critical first 2 years.
Oh, wouldn't that be wonderful? Mentorship.
Yes, and certain schools are doing it. They're doing it. The principal at our school had a mentor. I've seen it work really well, and I did a lot of research about it and have found that administrators, they have a very difficult job.
Yes,
it is. And the support they can get from somebody who's a tried-and-true veteran is priceless. And I think we really need to be supporting our administrators in their early years and then also throughout their careers, because this is a very challenging, changing job for them.
It is.
I think they need equal support.
They have tremendous responsibility, and there's so much transference and, you know, on call almost 24/7. I know that, having been an administrator. And so getting all the support you can is so necessary. Of course, in a private institution, the people who are coming because they like the administration. In a public school, you almost have a defensive attitude from many people as they approach it. And so giving the administrator support seems so essential, but if the teachers have input into it, that would be so much easier to be supportive. And some of the ideas that have come out in why great teachers quit and how we might stop the exodus there are so many great ideas and solutions in the book that I just hope that those people who are struggling for solutions will pick it up. And now to move on about respect and compensation, In the bureaucracy chapter there, you say states such as California, New York, Connecticut, and New Jersey demonstrate their high commitment to paying their teachers as professionals. And I think that that is very, very important. I just read an article yesterday about, you know, the importance of paying kindergarten teachers really well. You know, those are the most important years. And, of course, as a Montessori teacher, I know that those are the most important years. And if you talk to anyone who's doing brain research, you know those are the most important years. And yet we look at a kindergarten teacher like she's not doing anything. I mean, they should make as much as college professors, in my opinion.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you see that, you know, in the book. I have a couple comments from two different teachers from New York, and it talks about, you know, not just the increased compensation in their states, but also the sort of the feeling of being really respected in the community that sort of walks hand in hand with that.
Yes.
And just feeling connected and supported by the community, and then taking lots of pride in their work and wanting their schools to be successful. It seemed to me that those concepts really walked together. And I just found that, you know, those states are taking the lead in that way, and they're going to retain teachers more. I mean, certainly pay is not the only answer, but it is one part of the puzzle, and I think we all need to be looking at that.
Yes, I think the payment and the respect, in many ways, the payment may be, you know, saying we respect you enough to pay you well. But there are many people who do not go into it for the payment. They go into it for the respect. And so it just seems essential. Without the respect, I just don't know how they can do it. I know that many teachers do it, and I just admire them so much. Now,
they do it because they just love children. You know, they do it because they love teaching, they love children, they love working with families, and it's just clear that we have to value that as a society, to me.
Yeah, we have to value it again. We did value it once. I mean, I know that I really believed in public education, which is the reason why we moved to California, because, you know, it was second only to New York pre-Proposition 13. And, I mean, it was free. Education was free. You could go to college free. The public system was just so outstanding. And then it was just the most depressing thing, which is why I started a private school. Well, I really started a home school, and then people said, you know, people wanted to join me, and then it became a private school. But it was from that time I realized what was being taken away, and we know how to do this. We do know how to do this. And I think it's remarkable that so many teachers, I have sons who teach in the public system, and they teach in a charter school, and I have other sons who just, although they are great teachers, they just could not deal with these changes and went out into the professional world. So I see it from both angles. Well, now let's talk about parents, which is chapter 6. And I feel like parents are the child's first teachers.
Right.
And that parent education is really important. Yes, and that it should be an expectation. Is that too radical?
No, I think that parents are their child's best and first teacher, and we've seen the data shows that involved parents have their children have the most success academically and socially, and we want that so much. So I think we're finding the extremes of this issue. We're finding some parents who are not involved at all because economically they're flat out. You know, they're working 2-3 jobs, and it's really challenging. And then you see sort of the other end of the spectrum where you have some entitlement, and you have some parents who are doing some micromanaging at the classroom level, and is kind of sometimes in some cases sort of impeding the education of their own child.
Yes.
Without wanting to, and I heard this over and over again in my research and in all these different ways, and I share those anecdotes in this chapter.
Yes.
But I think it's really clear that we just need to involve and educate parents as to what's going on in public schools today, and that, you know, encourage them to be in close contact with the schools in all the avenues that schools are communicating, on websites and newsletters. And certainly teachers want to meet and talk about their child, but having a certain communication protocol where everybody understands how to get in touch and what it might look like is really important to set up at the beginning of the year, so that there's not a lot of miscommunication. And it's really challenging. So sometimes people really want to talk to maybe a teacher in the middle of the day, and if you've ever been a teacher, you know that it's difficult to find time to even use the bathroom. So it's really hard to get in touch with people during the teaching day. So there's just things like that we can develop certain protocols. Maybe certain teachers, you know, want to communicate via email, and they'll do so after school, or just setting up things that can support that relationship, because it's such a crucial relationship. And we can do such great things when we partner together, teachers and parents. So we really need to look at it from the lens of being on the same team to support the child.
Yeah, that was the original idea of PTA, of the Parent Teachers Association, that there would be this place where communication would take place. And, that's just a dream now, because, I mean, from my perspective, a lot of PTAs are just taken over by the most influential people in a community. And they become part of the problem. I hate to say that, but and I know that there are exceptions. But
definitely.
But this is how it seems. And you know that the section where you do talk about how difficult it is for a teacher to even go to the bathroom was one of the most powerful parts of the book, because I do not think that most people realize that you cannot leave the class. You cannot leave the classroom and go to the bathroom. You have to wait. Now,
you don't want to leave your children unsupervised.
Right, and we know that that's bad for the kids, let alone the teacher. And once again, I want to go back to if they would just do away with these huge buildings, and they would rent houses to do school, then people could go to the bathroom whenever they needed to go to the bathroom. I mean, that's what's so important is, you know, for the health, mental and physical, of the teachers and the students, that you should be able to go to the bathroom when you need to go to the bathroom.
And not worrying about leaving your children unsupervised. I think it also goes back to teacher input on school-wide schedules.
Yes.
You know, school-wide schedules are dictated by all sorts of things other than teacher input. And, just looking at what teacher has 3 hours in a row of instruction or of supervision without a break, is that realistic when they can't even step out just for 1 second? It's not. I think we have to look at schedules through that, through just that idea alone.
Yes, it's just, yes, for sure. That is a very important issue. And I don't, if you talked about it, I missed, what is the average class size
in most classes? I mean, I think you'd find a range nationally. I mean, I know that when I went and did an observation down in New York City several years ago, there was, I think it was 33 students in one classroom. Now, that was a long time ago, so that might have changed. I've had classes from 25 students all the way down to 17, and those are good numbers. I mean, I think that the for fifth and sixth grade, the grade I teach, anywhere from 17 to 21 is an optimal class size. And I know there's lots of research out there about this topic.
Yes. But, yes, there is.
It's unwieldy when you get into the mid-20s there, when you want to really do differentiated instruction and you want to meet the needs of each child. To have more than 20-some-odd children, the possibilities for that start to diminish when numbers get that high, even for our most qualified and trained and exceptional teachers.
Well, I don't know where the research went, but I found research when I did my training, and it stated that if you go over 17 to 1, retention drops by 70%. So, you know, and they just suppress this research, you know, just like they suppress the research that the tests are based on some old test to keep blacks out of the military. The SATs, they suppress that information. That's the thing that I don't understand, is how can they go beyond 17 to 1? And if they do, that there isn't a full-time aide in the classroom is just criminal. I mean,
right. And that's a really good topic, is that a lot of times, like here in Vermont, they'll say something that, oh, there's an adult for every 4 children. But when they are doing those numbers, they're including the school nurse, the PE teacher, and a lot of adults that aren't classroom teachers. And so it's a really skewed data point when you're thinking about that. That's a big point of contention here. Oh, well, there's so many adults in Vermont schools for the children. But, well, let's really look at it. How many classroom teachers are there? Per class.
Right.
Let's really think about that, and how many of them have full-time aides. Then we'll get some clear data. But when you just take the number of staff and you divide it by the number of students, that math doesn't really work.
That's right.
When you're considering direct contact.
That's right.
Children.
Well, I heard recently, today actually, on Amy Goodman, that there's this push now to lower the class size, and I thought, hallelujah, you know, small is so beautiful. If it was small enough so that each individual child, that whole child, could be, you know, regarded, and that whole child's learning style and that whole child's interest, and following that individual child and teaching that child, approaching that child through their interest. Why, the children are our future. You'd think we would want to invest that. And we have all
Absolutely.
These great trained teachers. We said, oh, we need teachers. And now we're treating them. I mean, as a society, we're treating them with such disrespect. So
they won't stay.
Yeah, they won't.
They won't stay teaching. I mean, just from, and that's the thing. It's also a cultural generational thing too, is that I think a lot of teachers are really idealistic and they're fresh out of college, they do this, and then they in 4 to 5 years think, you know, this is just, you know, either too much or physically, emotionally too much, and they move on.
Yes. Well, maybe they'll get some good ideas by reading your book, Katie.
I hope so. There are solutions. It's a solutions-based positive book. You know, in the end, I really wanted to move towards, what do the veteran teachers know that they can share with us in each of these topics? What are the things that they can impart to us after 30 years in the career? Because they have developed fantastic strategies. So what are their strategies? And then what can we do as teacher leaders, administrators, policymakers? What can we do to help? And there are some simple things that they're not, it's not rocket science. There are some things that we just have to focus on it. As much as we focus on curriculum and all of these things that good schools focus on, we have to really look at teacher sustainability and take it quite seriously.
Right. Yes. Yes. Very well said. Very well said. Well, the last chapter, which is called School Boards, and I think we covered it a bit in bureaucracy and administration, but do you have something that you'd like to say about school boards?
Sure. I think that school board members devote countless volunteer hours across the nation, and they are public servants that are looking out for schools and children everywhere, and I thank them for all of this time that they give. But what's tricky sometimes is that some teachers feel isolated from that experience, and so trying to have more teachers involved with school boards, just even going to the meetings and being there if they have any questions, is crucial. Because sometimes there's conversations happening in isolation, and then there's maybe even decisions in isolation when nobody's really been talking to the teachers. So I discuss in the book maybe a sense of shared leadership and responsibility between school boards and teachers. A simple action right away is to have your staff sign up two at a time to go to each school board meeting. Another thing that teachers can be doing is even presenting about their particular content area if the school board doesn't really know about it or wants to know about it. And then maybe even shared decision-making, maybe a committee that teachers and parents and community members can take on some of the leadership responsibilities. I know in Florida there's something called FAC, and it's a group that is made up of all those stakeholders, and they do take on some of the leadership responsibilities from the school board, school improvement, professional development, and it is happening. So there are models out there that are successfully involving teachers more in leadership, and I'd like to see more of those happen at the local and district levels.
Great. Great. Sounds wonderful. Okay. Thank you for that. Now, we've covered all the chapters, and there's something that I wanted to talk about in this interview, and that is so impressive to me, that in the fall of 2009, you received an Earthwatch Educator Fellowship to participate in a 10-day science research expedition to Louisiana to survey the swamps and cypress forests for the effects of climate change and extreme weather. And I just thought that was remarkable.
Thank you.
What a wonderful experience. And you communicated with your students through blog posts and internet videos. And so you engaged them in real life science research and field-based learning. That is so wonderful, Katie. I mean, just fantastic. I congratulate you on that, and it's so impressive.
Thank you so much.
Did you have fun?
Oh, I had a great time. It was sort of like a summer expedition camp for science teachers. Uh-huh. You know, we were all in this one room with bunks, all we'd be all there together, and then going out into the cypress swamps and things all day, and we were turning over individual leaves and looking for caterpillar species and chronicling on a handheld device all the data, you know, the plot uh-huh. points, locations, the weather conditions, what type of species of tree that it was on and what we found. And what was so refreshing for me to do as a science teacher was to go and live and breathe the work of scientists. It was fantastic. And then to come home, and not come home, but come back to the headquarters where we're all staying, and to share it with the students and show them my big rubber boots that came up to past my knees because of the snakes, and to show them the machete that I had, you know, that I had to whack down some of the bushes with, and show them the poisonous caterpillar, and even you talk about the caterpillar poop or the caterpillar's parasites and all this gooey science stuff, you know. They just loved it. You know, it was just such a great way to connect them, and I loved showing them that role that you can do anything. You can break out of any mold. I wanted them to see their teacher not in a stereotypical light,
right,
but as somebody who goes out of her comfort zone and somebody who does something different, and certainly really imparting on them that we need research and we need to address climate change in very real, meaningful
yes.
ways. So just all of that. It was an incredible experience. Earthwatch was gracious to fund it for teachers. They've got a great program, a fellowship program for teachers, and anybody can apply, and you just have to discuss how you're going to share it with your school and your school community. And it's incredible work. I hope to actually do it again. I'm going to apply again, hopefully in the next few years, and I'll go wherever they send me, and I'll do whatever they want me to do.
It just sounds wonderful. So unlike the traditional school marm. And for sure, but really the climate change, and you know, there's so many climate change deniers, and they get so much press, and it's so depressing. And
it's
just great to know that you were there in the classroom telling the kids how it is. And of course, it's really sad what's happened with the oil. I can't call it a spill, it's a gusher.
I know.
That is just to think that you were there before it happened. So,
mm-hmm. And, you know, and we were there measuring the damage from Katrina. We were there already looking at devastation and the impacts of that. You know, and of course that was natural. But when you just think about a region and you think about challenges to ecosystems, it's just mind-boggling.
It is mind-boggling. It's very mind-boggling. Well, we've run up against the time here. This has been so wonderful for me, Katie. I can't thank you enough for taking the time. And I want you to thank your family for sharing you with me this morning, or afternoon for you, right?
Yes, there was some clever orchestration that needed to happen here. So I'll be sure to pass along the thanks to my husband, who's running around with them right now. Athena, it was truly a pleasure to speak with you. You have so many great ideas, and it was really a treat to be here with you today.
Thank you so much. And we should mention your great website on the non-toxic. What is it? Non-toxic kids. Yes.
Yep.
Non-toxic kids.
And that's
kids.
A green parenting site. Yeah, it's about just raising kids as naturally as we can in an increasingly toxic world. I share a lot of links and I do some product reviews and talk about the news and how we can digest it as parents, because often a lot of this is overwhelming.
So it's the traditional 3 W's, non-toxickids, all one word, .net, and then the book, Why Great Teachers Quit, all one word, strungtogether.com, no 3 W's, and both are on Facebook. Yes. Thank you so much, Katie.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining me for the launch of this interview with Katie Faber. Katie wanted to be sure you all got the message loud and clear to support the teachers. And I want to say that I made a statement during the interview, which I feel was misleading, that kindergarten teachers should be paid as well as college professors. Well, the fact is that most college professors make less than most fourth grade teachers. Today, teachers across the board, elementary through college level, are underpaid. So support the teachers. We need to support them all. Contact information for Katie Faber and her book Why Great Teachers Quit and How We Might Stop the Exodus is whygreatteachersquit.com, all one word and no 3 W's. That's whygreatteachersquit.com. Katie Faber's website for non-toxic kids is 3 W's dot non-toxickids.net. That's 3 W's dot non-toxickids.net. Education Now is a production of the Hermeneutic Institute for Holistic Health and Education, a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. Education Now broadcasts and podcasts are listed on the American Montessori website at 3 W's.amshq.org. That's 3ws.amshq.org. All broadcasts and podcasts on Education Now are available for listening and free download at this website. This is Athena Melville, your host for Education Now, saying good night. Our next podcast will be Thursday, August 19th. Until then, let me leave you with Katie Faber's request. Support our teachers.
You are on the road, must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know.